professor of philosophy at UC School of Philosophy. My guest is Colin Hanson, a resident science writer in the UK, and we're going to be discussing the origin of astrology by the heavy metals master.
Thank you very much for having me.
What you want to do, or what you do in your book, The Origins of Virtue, is to try to provide an evolutionary explanation, if not of virtue itself, at least the possibility of virtue within human communities. I could imagine though someone saying, what's the problem? What needs to be explained? Why is it, does there appear to be a problem explaining the origins of virtue evolutionarily?
Well, I think that we're quite used to the idea that our nasty side, the nasty side of human nature, is something that is natural, that is instinctive, that is in us. We talk about our animal behavior when people are selfish or violent. We say that's their animal side, and we think that when we're not like that, when we're sociable or cooperative or altruistic in some way, that it's that it's somehow a civilized veneer over an animal, that it's not, that it didn't evolve in our natures, that it was imposed on us by society later on. And I think that's very misleading. I think a lot of our very nice habits, our cooperative habits, our sociable habits, our altruistic habits, are just as innate, show just as much instinctive component, and have evolved for a purpose just as much as our more competitive habits.
Okay, so if you're right, then we don't have to think about humans as being basically evil, and then society comes in to socialize us and to remove our evil elements, that you can see the good elements, the good parts of human beings, as evolving along with everything else about us.
That's correct. I don't wish to imply by that in some sense we're all nice, and perhaps Rousseau would have had it, that we're noble savages, and that society has come along and corrupted us, and that civilization is the source of the nastiness of our behavior. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying we do have both sides in our nature. We have Dr. Jekyll and we have Mr. Hyde, but both of them have evolutionary roots that go way back, and that you can trace how and why they came into existence.
Okay. Now, in your book, you fairly early begin to talk about the prisoner's dilemma as a way of both showing why we need an explanation for the origins of virtue. Explain the prisoner's dilemma to the listener and why that seems to be important for understanding.
Yeah, the prisoner's dilemma has become a sort of emblematic way of talking about the problem of cooperation, because what it does is it makes it plain just how hard it is to get two egotists to cooperate without trying to take advantage of each other. It concerns the original story is of two people who've been caught by the police and held in separate cells, and the police are putting pressure on each of them to confess and implicate his accomplice. And this way, each individual has to sit down and think to himself, can I trust my accomplice to stay silent? If he doesn't, he'll implicate me and I'll go down for the whole crime. So it brings up this question of how much you can trust the other guy to cooperate with you. But the interesting thing about the prisoner's dilemma is that when you forget about prisoners for a moment and turn it into just a little mathematical game that is played, if you play that game once, it's quite clear that the only sensible thing to do is to confess and screw your partner and hope that he's almost bound to do the same, but at least you're better off than if he had confessed and implicated you. If, on the other hand, you play the game again and again, you find some rather interesting things emerging, and that is that you can build up with your partner a sort of two-way rapport. You can start to say, look, I cooperated, I stayed silent for the last few times, then you should do the same, and that way we can build up a relationship of trust between us.
Okay. Maybe go back a bit, a little bit more, explain why the prisoner's dilemma was thought to be a problem, because it always focused on what you did once in a relationship with an individual, and why within that situation the temptation was always, to use your language, to defect.
Yes. Well, the prisoner's dilemma was, of course, set up this way in order to make it a dilemma. What it essentially says that if whatever the other guy does, you're better off defecting. If he cooperates, you can exploit him by defecting. If he defects, you don't end up being a dupe by cooperating, and so you defect too. You reduce your punishment, as it were. So if that's the case, you defect, and he comes to the same conclusion, you're both defect, you would both have been better off if you'd both cooperated. If you knew you were both going to do the same thing, you want to cooperate, but you end up defecting. It's not, of course, very easy to explain on the radio. It's one of those things that it would be very nice to show graphically. But the point is that economists invented this game in the 1950s, and they played it a lot throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And there was always an anomaly that people seemed, if you said it in front of ordinary people, they cooperated in this game much more than you would expect, given the rationality of the situation. And that's fine, because economists are quite used to concluding that we human beings are irrational and not very clever. And they got on with that conclusion, and there we were. But then suddenly in the early 1980s, when computers were set the same problem, lo and behold, they did the same thing. Computer programs which cooperated did better than ones that didn't. And that was when game theorists sat up and took notice and said, there's something going on here that we need to understand. And what they understood, what they concluded, was that in a game like this, there is a great power in reciprocity, in swapping and exchanging favors. I do you a favor, you do me a favor, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, do as you would be done by, etc., etc. And that kind of behavior can act as a sort of scaffolding on which to build what looks like a very cooperative structure, but which is in fact enlightened self-interest on the part of the two individuals.
Okay. Now, again, I don't know if we want to get into too great detail, but one of the things that the various computer programs showed is that there's slight variations on how you can understand reciprocity. You can understand reciprocity as just being pure tit for tat. Whatever you do to me, I'll do back to you. And of course, one of the problems that emerges if both parties are strict tit for tat players, and if the first person defects, then what you have is this non-ending spiral of everyone trying to do the other person in.
Yes, you get locked into a vicious spiral of, which is very similar to the kinds of tit-for-tat murder spirals that you get in mafia societies, as it were. You know, that is reciprocal just as much as being nice can be reciprocal. And as a result, tit-for-tat, that very simple program that simply does what the other guy did last time, is a little vulnerable to all sorts of problems like that. And nowadays there are computer programs that play the prisoner's dilemma that are much more robust to that sort of problem, but are essentially still reciprocating, essentially still looking to achieve cooperation by punishing those who punish you and rewarding those who reward you. And this has interesting parallels in the animal kingdom, although not quite as many as we might have hoped to find. There are clear cases of reciprocity, of tit-for-tat in vampire bats, curiously, dolphins, chimpanzees, and so on. But these tend to be very big-brained animals. So animals with smaller brains don't seem to have the capacity for identifying other individuals and so on that would enable them to carry out a sophisticated strategy like this.
Could you fill out the examples of maybe a couple of those in the animal kingdom? Because I think those illuminate the point you're wanting to make.
Yeah, well, I think probably the neatest example is the story of the vampire bats, which a vampire bat roosts in a hollow tree or somewhere like that, and it tends to know its neighbors, as it were. It roosts in the same place every night, and the bat next to it is the same one every night, and so on. And each bat flies out at night and looks for a... Sorry, it roosts in the day. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. Each bat flies out at night and looks for an animal from which to suck some blood as a meal, and there's quite a high chance that the bat will come back hungry. It has not got enough blood. And if that happens, two or three nights running, the bat will starve to death. So, obviously, but if it does find a meal, it tends to get too much. It gets so much that it's bloated and it doesn't need all the food. So obviously there's a degree of advantage in sharing here. If one bat can share with another bat, it can even out this problem of feast and famine. And so indeed you get sharing, but you get a very interesting pattern where if a bat does not share, if for one reason or another it does not respond to the demands of another bat that it share some blood with it, then it will be punished by that bat in turn. And you find that bats only feed bats that have fed them in the past or vice versa, which seems to be a very clear case of playing tit for tat. Now, that's a very familiar idea for us human beings, too. I mean, you know, we quite clearly reciprocate in that sort of way a lot in our social lives. We look out for people who simply never return favors, and we tend to cut them off, ostracize them, or something like that. On the other hand, I think that in human beings there's something else going on which is a little different, but very similar, which you might call exchange, which is not exchanging the same favor at different times, but exchanging different things at the same time. So I give you money and you give me whatever it is you're selling, or something like that.
Okay. Hey, you mentioned a point I'd like to elaborate on, that the cases where we find in the animal kingdom are only cases where the animals are big brain, they have some kind of cognitive sophistication. We see it in human beings who are cognitively sophisticated creatures. Now, what does cognitive sophistication have to do with it? Explain the import of that.
I think all that it really has to do with it in this case is the ability to remember past events in sufficient detail. In other words, to recognize individuals, for a start, which a lot of animals probably don't. They probably don't have the capacity to recognize individual members of their species. Higher animals do, clearly, but, you know, fish probably don't, for example. It takes quite a lot of brain power in our brain. Facial recognition is a big chunk of our visual cortex, and we're very, very good at it, as plenty of examples would show. So you've got to recognize him, and then you've got to remember about this guy that you recognize. You've got to remember, you know, he wouldn't return a favor when I paid him a favor. Or on the other hand, yes, okay, he was generous to me last time, so I'll be generous to him this time, and so on. Now, that is quite a sophisticated piece of calculus, and you do need quite a lot of gray matter to do it. That seems to be the reason why the search for reciprocity in the animal kingdom has, on the whole, been fairly disappointing. We're only finding it in chimpanzees and dolphins and big brain animals like that. And even there, it's not a huge part of their behavior. It's not, in dolphins, for example, the reciprocity is used in an entirely competitive way. It's not used to build a nice, noble society. It's built between groups of male dolphins that use each other's assistance to steal female dolphins from other groups of males. That's hardly, you know, the stuff of social virtue, as it were, if we're looking for parallels with human behavior.
Okay. So there are at least a couple of elements. One is just being able to identify the other individual as a specific individual, and secondly, it's being able to remember what that specific individual did to you in the past, correct?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Now, we want to go in two directions here, and eventually we want to talk about how this develops in human beings to what we might consider more full-blown virtue. But let's also run backwards and ask, how could this ability to engage in reciprocal behavior have evolved?
Well, it isn't, of course, immediately easy to see, you know, what the steps were in this sort of thing first beginning to appear. But you know, it's quite a leap from not recognizing individuals to suddenly having all this sophisticated stuff in place. But I think it's quite easy to imagine that there would be intermediary stages where animals would have some of these abilities but not all of them, would occasionally recognize an individual sufficiently to remember a little bit about them and that sort of thing. So I think that's the kind of thing we're talking about. I mean, the animals are not our ancestors, you know. I mean, animals are just as much descendants of their own ancestors today as, you know, the ancestors are all dead of everybody. But you can look in other animals for animals that have not yet been through the kind of transitions that we may have been through in some particular direction, and learn from them what our ancestors may have looked like at a stage when they were going through a similar transition. And that's really what one's looking at animal models for, is not to try and say that, you know, we did it exactly the same as them, but this might shed light on what our particular ancestors did when they reached that particular stage. And clearly, when you get to the apes, the great apes particularly, the chimpanzees and the gorillas, you see the sorts of society, for want of a better word, in which there is a great deal of cooperation, a certain amount of division of labor, but not nearly as much as in human beings, and a great deal of knowledge of individuals and so on. So, you know, our common ancestor with chimpanzees and with gorillas probably had that sort of capability already 7 or 8 million years ago.
Okay. Well, before we go on and proceed this further, I'd like to welcome anyone who may have tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is science writer Matt Ridley, and we're discussing the origins of virtue. One of the last points you made when you were talking about human beings was that the sort of more elaborate reciprocal behavior was not pure tit for tat. It wasn't that exactly what you did for me, I'll do for you, but that higher animals, certainly human beings, perhaps some other animals too, have the ability to make exchanges, which is, I'll do one thing for you and you may do something else for me. So it is sort of reciprocal behavior, but not the straightforward tit for tat. You suggest in your book that this is closely tied up with economic trade. Could you elaborate on that for the listeners? I think that's very interesting.
Yes, I think that I think we've often confused two uses of the word reciprocity. I mean, when you talk to an anthropologist about reciprocity, he essentially means trade. He means the exchanging of different things. But if you talk to a game theorist, he means the exchanging of the same things at different times. Now, it's quite difficult to imagine yourself in the situation where you have something now that somebody else will have later. I mean, if you had to go to a grocery store and pay in groceries that you've got for the groceries you want from the grocery store because you have a temporary surplus and he has a temporary surplus and you have to do the reverse thing the next week, it's a pretty implausible situation. We're much more often in the situation where I've got thing A, I've got some meat because I've just killed an animal, say, or something, and you've got some nuts because you've just been digging in the ground or wherever, and I'd like some of your nuts and you'd like some of my meat so we can do a swap. Now that's a much more obvious sort of human predicament to find ourselves in. And I think that trade between individuals of this kind, exchange between individuals, is not only a peculiarly human feature, but it goes back a lot further than we think. And we know this partly because if we look at hunter-gatherer human beings, of which there are quite a lot of extant peoples in the world, we get some kind of glimpse of how human beings must have lived before agriculture and how they must have lived for 400,000, maybe even a million years. We have evidence of hunting going back at least 400,000 years and evidence of gathering from the kinds of stuff left behind going back just about as long. So it looks like human beings were doing this peculiar thing of hunting-gathering, eating a lot more meat than most other apes, but not relying entirely on meat, relying on vegetable food too. And if you look at existing hunter-gatherers, you find that all the hunting is done by men and all the gathering is done by women. But they always exchange the produce. It's not that women only eat gathered food and men only eat hunted food. It's that there is a very, very sophisticated and regular process of exchange between the genders and also between individuals of the same gender within a tribe. And this has huge ecological advantages because meat is a very good, high-quality source of food, but it's a very low-reliability source of food. I mean, you might catch a giraffe one day and then go empty-handed for 6 months or something like that, so that's not much good. But by evening out the supply with the much lower-quality source of gathered food, you end up with the best of both worlds. So from that case, I would argue that this kind of exchange must have been a key ecological feature of our species. And if you then take the case of trade itself, by which I mean trade between groups, you know, between America and Britain or between, one tribe and another tribe, as opposed to between individuals, there has been a tendency to assume in economics that that's very recent, that trade comes after government, after law, after all the sophistication of the modern state, probably after agriculture. Well, I don't think that's the case at all. I think there's evidence that trade was going on a very long time ago. There's very good evidence of Stone Age hunter-gatherer people indulging in trade. My favorite example is a group of Aborigines in Northern Australia, who were first contacted in the 19th century, who were trading stone axes for stingray barbs, which were used on the ends of spears. And there was, you could see an exchange rate for these two items right the way across several different tribes, so that the stone axe would be worth several stingray barbs at one end of the route, and vice versa at the other end. Really very sophisticated levels of trade. And we sort of assume that if you go back 200,000 years, you find our ancestors sitting around on the savannah, and he has to make all his own food and all his own clothes and all, you know, has to do everything for himself. And I don't think that's the case. I think human beings have been trading with each other and therefore specializing for a lot longer than we think.
Well, and one of the things you talk about it is that even if you have an individual or a tribe that is more efficient at hunting, at gathering, at making axes, at getting stingray barbs, the worse, it still is to their advantage not to do all of those things.
That's
but
right.
To trade. Could you explain that to listeners? I think yes. That's an important step in your argument.
Well, it's David Ricardo's law of comparative advantage, David Ricardo being a 19th century economist. What he was trying to explain is that he was arguing for free trade in very political terms. He was a member of Parliament in Britain, the same applies on the sort of Stone Age level to human beings in a hunter-gatherer situation. If I make stone axes and stones and wooden spears, and I'm better at it than you, better at making both of them than you, it can still pay me to get my spears from you, because let's say I'm much better at making axes than spears, but you're slightly better at making spears than axes, but you're worse at making both than me, then I can make an extra axe and give it to you for a spear, and I'm better off, and you're actually better off. We're both better off. It's not a zero-sum game. Now, for me and you, substitute Japan and America and semiconductors and airplanes or something, and you've immediately got the story of why free trade need not be a zero-sum game, why, in fact, both sides can be better off for, and why even if Japan is better at making everything than America, or vice versa, it'll still pay Japan to trade some things with America. It's a terribly simple idea in some ways, and it's a terribly counterintuitive one in others. It's not an easy idea to grasp hold of, but it means both that there will always be an advantage in trading, and that there will tend to be an advantage in specialization, and that as the global economy increases, for example, you'll tend to get more and more specialization of manufacturing and services provided by different nations, different groups, and so on. And that was probably going on to a certain extent before the invention of agriculture.
Okay. So there are clear advantages of cooperating with other people. But now, in a way, we go back to one of the early questions, that if we are primarily selfish creatures and we find ourselves in the equivalent of prisoner's dilemmas, we can't always wait on the other person to take the first step to be generous to us before we decide if we're going to be generous mm-hmm. back. We have to engage in a certain sort of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And we often do that without having any experience at all with the individual.
Right.
Now, again, the old model of the prisoner's dilemma, that sort of trust was irrational.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't trust the other person on the front end. And yet, you want to say that there's a perfectly good explanation, an evolutionary explanation for why we do trust, and it has to do with the emotions.
That's right. The individual who narrowly calculates his self-interest at every stage and says, well, it's all very well me saying that I might be better off if I give this guy something in the hope that he'll return me a bigger favor later, but I can't be sure, and he could walk off with it, that guy's called a rational fool. That's a technical term invented by economists, and we're obviously not rational fools in that sense. We don't always calculate a very short-term version of self-interest, and we are prepared in some sense to take a risk. That's really the point, to take a risk that to commit ourselves to a course of action that requires reverse cooperation from someone else. But in the first instance, it's us that's putting the money in, it's us that, I don't know, whatever it might be. There's a very, very nice theory developed by Robert Frank at Cornell University, which essentially argues that the way we avoid being rational fools in this sense is by using our emotions. And that may be even be the function of our emotions, because they commit us to courses of action. So that the fact that I'm going to get angry if you renege on the deal is something you have to take into account before you selfishly renege on the deal we've made. The fact that two individuals need to commit themselves to a long-term marriage, for example, requires them to invest. Requires them not to commit themselves not to take a short-term exit from that marriage at the first available opportunity. And so, in that sense, you need an emotional guarantee. You need something called love, which doesn't die easily, as it were. I think this is a very nice idea for explaining why the emotions may indeed have evolved, and they get over what's known as the commitment problem. And then if you think about something as simple as why human beings smile at strangers, I mean, if I walk into a shop, I smile at the person, you know, from whom I'm buying something. Well, maybe, you know, I don't excessively smile, but, you know, I would, you show a certain, a person you meet for the first time, you shake their hand, you give them a smile. Now, why is that smile there? It's essentially a, look, I'm prepared to show a generous and social and cooperative nature towards you. Are you prepared to reciprocate? It's a sort of, it's looking, I think we're constantly looking to solicit and elicit trust from each other and cooperation.
Now, when we do that, Tom, it's certainly clear that if we meet someone and they're very standoffish,
mm-hmm.
if they're very cold, then we are going to be disinclined to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, this raises a question which I can imagine someone having about your explanation, that it still looks at bottom as if your explanation for the origins of virtue is at bottom selfish. And someone might wonder, is this then really an explanation of virtue at all?
Well, we define, I suppose all you're saying there in a sense is that if I can find self-interest, enlightened self-interest, you know, eventual self-interest in the behavior, then it can't be virtuous. That's simply redefining virtue. I think you can be very virtuous, but be doing it for what is usually a long-term, enlightened, self-interested reason.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show and speaking today with Matt Ridley.
Very nice to be here.
We've been discussing the origins of virtue. This is Hugh LeBlanc, Ideas and Issues. Good day.